Water Banter.
Boom. And we are live with another episode of the Brown Water Banter Podcast. My name is Jared Seymour.
My name is Joey Cates.
That's right. And we have a great show in studio today. Christina Dent, the founder of End It For Good, a nonprofit who focuses on drug policy reform would be the best way to say that. We had the CEO from End It For Good on the show, episode 99, about 2 years ago. Ooh. We just looked that up. So time flies when you're having fun.
Crazy.
That's Brown Water getting old.
And getting super old, dude. Especially when you go on our tab section of how many seasons we've had.
Yeah.
It's like, we've been doing
it
this
on
long.
And on.
A lot of gray hair.
Oh, God, that's what these wrinkles. No, I'm just kidding. But no, it's going to be a great conversation. We're going to talk about drug policy, drugs, how they affect people, and maybe open up some of the listeners, viewers' eyes to some things you may not have thought about before. It's going to be a great conversation, so we're looking forward to it. Before we jump into it, like we always do, though, we want to thank the people that keep the lights on for us over here at the Brown Water Studio. And right out of the gate, Dr. Robbie Williams over at Southern Magnolia Smiles. They are located on Washington Avenue in Ocean Springs. You can look them up on the socials at Southern Magnolia Smiles on Facebook and Instagram. 2024 is the year to smile more, so go get those pearly whites shined up. Book that appointment by giving them a call at 228-215-1202. If you find yourself in need for legal representation for any reason, we highly recommend Taylor & Cox Law Firm. They are a sponsor of the show. They specialize in felonies, misdemeanors, DUIs, family law, divorce, child custody, you name it. If you need representation and someone that's going to fight tooth and nail for you, Taylor & Cox is your go-to. Give them a shout over at 228-696-0111 and tell them we sent you. Rocky Brooks over at Sea to Swamp. He's got two locations down on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. He's got your tackle and apparel needs covered. You can check him out on Facebook at C2 and then Swamp. The Gulfport store is busting at the seams. He's got kayaks he's slinging.
And he just got a new air conditioner system put in today.
Okay. So summertime's rolling around. If you want to go in there and hang out and
suck
some of
that.
Yeah,
it's nice and cool now.
Yeah, you can enjoy that. So go check him out. Look him up on Facebook. And you can give him a call as well at 228-205-3964. Our buddy Kendrick over at Forever Young Men and Women's Health. If you find yourself lethargic, you can't get back in the gym, you can't start a workout routine or start exercising like you want to, you just feel like a big turd, go over to Forever Young Men and Women's Health. You can look them up on Facebook as well. Book that a consultation with them, both men and women, and Kendrick can do some lab work on you and see if you're vitamin deficient or if you're hormone deficient. He specializes in testosterone replacement for both men and women, if you can believe that or not. So go check them out. Put your health care in the hands of a professional and let them take care of you. Give them a shout at 228-363-6623. And Dewey Do Bugs over in D'Iberville. We've been mentioning them a bunch lately. We just got off the past weekend with our Bay Rat Bash tournament that they hosted at their place. It's over in D'Iberville, right across the street from the Scarlet Pearl. You can look them up on Facebook as well. Dewey Do Bugs. That's Bugs with a Z. Great boiled seafood, just an all-around well-designed restaurant. It looks great in there. The art, everything, it smells wonderful. It's a really cool addition to the Gulf Coast that we were definitely, at least in this area, lacking. So we want to thank them for being a part of the show and sponsoring us as well. So thank y'all for paying attention to all that. Joey's still slinging it out. I think I beat him again. As I mentioned, we have Christina in the studio. End It For Good, a nonprofit organization focusing on drug policy reform, education, getting the word out, really just getting the conversation started, right, is one of the big things. But if you could, I know a little bit of your backstory, having gone to one of your events I talked to you about in Pascagoula before we went live. But for the people that are hearing about End It For Good the first time, could you give us like a little intro into how you got here?
Yeah. So we are coming up on our 5-year anniversary as a nonprofit.
5 years.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah.
But we really started back in 2017. I had this life-changing experience as a foster parent. And before that time, really, like, drugs and addiction had not touched me at all. I didn't use. I really was not around that in
family members.
High school, college. It just was not really part of my world. And so I kind of just took what I took from the culture, like drugs are bad, people who use drugs, not good.
Nancy Reagan, DARE.
I grew up in the
80s. Just say no.
It just was like, okay, I don't really have any interest in that anyway. So I didn't really have a there was nothing that kind of caused me to rethink anything.
Correct.
Until I was in my early 30s. We became foster parents. Through that experience, I met the mother of one of our foster sons, Joanne. And she had been struggling with an addiction for about 20 years at that point. She started using in her early teens, and it kind of went in and out of kind of seasons of like less chaotic and more chaotic use. But at the time that I met her, she was pregnant with her first child, had just had him, and he was taken into foster care because she could not beat that addiction during her pregnancy. So he came to our house. We became his foster family, and meeting her at his first visit with her was just this kind of shattering experience for me. I took him to the local child welfare office and got out of my van and turned around in the parking lot, and here comes this woman running towards me, and she's weeping. She runs over and just starts kissing this baby. This is his mom.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm coming from the way I've thought about it always, like, oh no, this is like a bad person.
Right. Selfish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I wouldn't, you know, thinking as myself, I'm a mom. I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't use drugs while I was pregnant. And yet here is this mom who's showing me like a really raw and vulnerable love, just not holding back. She's like, I am desperate to be near my son, mm-hmm. even if it's for 1 hour that I get to spend with him. And that really was at the beginning of this learning journey for me, because, you know, the first time that happens, anything that kind of pushes on us, we're like, one time experience, I can kind of like shove that off.
Right.
Right.
But I couldn't, because we were still fostering him and we still had communication with her. And so she went to inpatient treatment. She would call me from treatment and ask me to put her on speakerphone, and she would sing to him over the phone. And the more that I got to know her, the more I could not just shove that off to the side. Like I had to deal with, this is a mom like me. This is a woman who deeply loves her son. Mm-hmm. And she's struggling with an addiction to, at that time it was methamphetamine. So highly stigmatized addiction. Mm-hmm. And yet what I'm seeing is this mom who desperately wants to be a mom, wants to parent her son, loves him just as much as I love my sons. And so I was kind of forced in a way to hold two things I thought didn't go together and realize they do. She was simultaneously struggling with this really complex health crisis, and she was a mom like me. And that really was the beginning of this rethinking, because my support, I'm a lifelong Mississippian, grew up in a wonderful Christian conservative home, and had always supported this kind of like tough criminal approach. And now I was being confronted with kind of the other side of that, I began to realize that really was based on this idea that Joanne is a bad person who needs to be punished for what she's doing. And as I got to know her, realizing there's a whole lot more there. How can we help her address this so that she can be the mom that she wants to be, so she can raise her son, so he can have his mom in his life? And that was really this beginning of a learning journey, a change of mind, beginning of an organization.
If only it was that cut and dry, right? Mm-hmm. They're just bad people and they should be punished and, you know, whatever, and that's going to fix everything. But unfortunately, it's not that.
We've got a long history of it not working.
Yeah, there are some that don't work, but there are mm-hmm. some, like the cases you're talking about, where they really want to be a part of it. They just keep getting drugged back, drugged back, and they really want to be there.
Yeah, so that experience for you was like kind of like earth shattering, like broke some of your walls down that you didn't realize you had up, right?
Yeah, yeah, because I hadn't really come close to it before, and so it was kind of easy to just keep believing the same thing I'd always kind of grown up with and not being challenged in that. Or if it was challenged, it was really easy to kind of like explain away just, you know, we're really good at not confronting things we don't want to confront.
Right.
Yeah.
No matter what it is in our lives, we're really good at explaining away whatever, you know? Yeah. It was this start of, wait a second, I'm a foster parent because I want to be part of bringing healing to children's lives and then by extension their families who are hurting and suffering. And what I'm seeing is that his mom is also hurting and suffering. And so it made me address not just her, but I started thinking about all the other people like her. Right. So here she's using an illegal drug. So if she hadn't gone to treatment and had been arrested instead, what would happen to her? What would happen to her son? She's a single mom. You know, would he just be in foster care? Would she lose him forever? And that really began to bother me because it felt like, wait a second, I'm here because I want to be part of helping vulnerable families. And I think some of the ways that we're approaching this is actually tearing them apart rather than helping build them up and give them the support that they need.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And it's funny how like in your case, and I'm sure you're definitely not the only person, when you're not experienced with something or you're not around something,
you have no idea.
It's hard to understand the intricacies of something that's not even as complex as addiction.
Yeah, which is right? Super complex.
It's probably one of the most complex issues ever. My background is a little bit different than that. I've seen it in my life through family members, relatives, whatever, a lot. For a long time, and multiple occasions, multiple reasons, multiple different types of substances, let's just say. So it's always been a topic that I've been interested in, especially when you talk about the laws and the reform. I know like Ron Paul, as a candidate that ran for president, I was very much into kind of his philosophy on things when it comes to drug reform. Joey, I don't
rehabilitate instead of locking them up forever.
Well, for sure. Yeah. And like you said, it's hard for people to empathize with someone because, and I struggle even still with this part of it. You want to say it's a choice. That's a choice that you at least made in the beginning. Whether you can not make that choice now, maybe that's a different story. But that, I think that is very hard to process for people. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I think probably the biggest challenge for everyone that's thinking about this issue of accountability, of wanting people to be accountable for their actions. And I would say I completely agree with that. So number one is we can always swing the pendulum too far a different direction. And we're really good at that as humans. We're like, we don't like this thing over here. Let's swing it way over
off
to this other extreme.
Let's get rid of everything and do a 180 on it.
And do a 180. That's almost never helpful, no matter what issue you're talking about. Like the best path is often somewhere in between, whatever the extremes are. And so when we think about accountability, you think about like there are lots of different types of accountability. The criminal justice system is only one of those kinds. There's lots of, you might lose your job if you show up drunk every time. That's a legal drug that you can get, but there's still going to be some consequences to that if you allow that to take over your life. You might lose your marriage. You might lose your kids. You might lose lots of things. There are lots of different ways that we hold people accountable other than arresting them for whatever it is that we think is unhealthy in their life or unhelpful to them. Mm-hmm. So with alcohol, we allow people to drink. We even allow them to get drunk if that's what they choose. But we build in this accountability structure for the community. You can't drink and drive.
Right.
You can't go beat someone and say, I couldn't help it. I was drunk. Like, we don't,
you're still
responsible. Sorry.
Absolutely.
That's still assault. You know, you go and steal something. We don't say, well, gosh, they were, you know, they were high or they were drunk. I mean, how could they really know what they were doing? You're still responsible. You're still held accountable for what you're doing if you're committing some other crime. So I think in one sense, it feels like if we say arresting people just for drug possession is not helpful, the fear is that we go and swing this other direction where we don't hold people accountable at all. We just say, well, you know, they couldn't help it. And we want to say, no, there's a middle ground where it's not just drug possession that somebody can have their life ruined with a criminal record over, but it's also not go do whatever you want to. You can hurt whoever you want. You can break whatever other law.
Right.
Like, no, that is not the path either. There's a way that you can offer somebody help and you can hold them accountable for the ways they might hurt other people in the community that is not okay. And that they need to be held accountable for, because that's the kind of accountability that produces positive change in people's lives. When you think about criminal justice accountability, think about what are the main reasons that people struggle with addiction over? We know now, we didn't used to know, we do know now that the level of trauma a person has experienced earlier in their life is the most significant factor that plays into their risk factor. Doesn't mean everybody who had a painful childhood is going to become addicted, but it does mean their risk factor goes up by like a couple hundred percent.
Odds go up.
Yes, odds go up. They've got a lot more against them if they ever try drugs. Their chances of developing a problematic relationship are really high. And so we can say, okay, we know that that's the case. So when you think about what incarceration does to somebody, it puts them in
drug university.
That's true.
I mean, right? Criminal
what
university.
Yeah, what you want. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So number one, drugs are available in prisons and jails all over the place. Mm-hmm. You can, I've had a lot of people say it was actually easier to get it inside because it was literally like brought to me. Yeah. I didn't even have to like go anywhere.
And you don't have anything else to do
with the birthday cake.
Just, right. Go. It just is like there. I'm like right here in my cell and here it is. So people can get drugs in jails and prisons. So even if you arrest them, it's not going to stop them from using drugs.
Right.
But it is going to expose them to an extremely traumatic environment. All kinds of abuse are rampant in jails and prisons. Mental, physical, sexual, emotional.
It's a fight.
It is a kind of free for all.
Right.
Is a lot of people's experience there. Mm. So we're exposing people to this extremely traumatic environment and taking away their employment. If they had a job, that's hard to keep. If you don't show up for your job for a month, 2 months, you know, your job has moved on. Hard to keep housing if you don't have income coming in from your job. Hard to keep your family together if you're not there to be part of those relationships. So we're giving people more pain, disconnection, and trauma in their lives when we put them in the criminal justice system. And we're trying to solve a problem through that that's actually made worse by trauma. It really is like pouring gasoline on a fire. Mm. And we've done it for decades, and we keep standing back at that fire as it grows and grows, and we say, I don't understand it. Why doesn't it work?
It's still not working.
It's just still not working. The fire is getting bigger. And what we keep doing, which is crazy, is that we keep pouring more gas on, and even though the fire keeps getting bigger, we keep going, maybe just a little more.
A little bit more is going to work.
Maybe just a little more is going to work this time. If we put them in there for 20 years instead of 10 years, maybe that's going to make them really change their ways.
Let's use a different type of gas.
Right.
That's been the problem. It ain't the gas that's the problem. Let's do a different
type of
gas.
This diesel burns slower. Let's use it.
Let's try that. Or like, you know.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, I definitely understand that part of it. So when you saw the situation that made you kind of question your beliefs, if that's the right word to use, what did you then do next? How did we get to a nonprofit? Because a lot of people might have just shrugged that off.
Yeah, I'm going to credit Joanne 100% with this because I feel like her openness to let me see who she really is, to not hold me at arm's length, but to really let me in, it affected me so deeply that I felt like I think that one of the best things I could do for families involved in foster care, for kids in foster care, is to learn about this drug issue. Because more than half of the kids in Mississippi's foster care system are there for some sort of drug-related cause.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right. So, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you say it already? When you went to foster care, did you know the mother had an addiction problem?
When they called us with the like, so a social worker will call you as a foster parent and say, hey, we have a baby who needs a foster home. And you can say, can you tell me more about the situation? And they can sometimes say, you know, it's a baby that was removed for the mother's prenatal drug use or something like that. So we did know that that was the reason that he was coming to us.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
So I started learning because I really felt like there's something here. And it almost immediately when I started learning, it was like the world just kept opening more and more. And I kept thinking, people have no idea how much of our lives are affected by how we approach drugs and addiction. Yes. It affects everything from educational opportunity. You can have that taken away from you. If you have a drug conviction, you're not eligible for certain loans or grants. Even low-level drug convictions. We think, well, maybe a little slap on the wrist is going to help someone. Even a misdemeanor on your record has a lifetime negative impact on your income production. If you have a felony on your record, your lifetime income drops in half. And here's the thing.
Because most companies don't hire felons.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
One in 10 Mississippians has a felony on their record.
Wow.
I wouldn't have guessed that high.
Yeah.
It is shocking. So we have one in 10 has a felony. One in 4 has a criminal conviction of some kind. That's mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. And we talk about
Do you mean drug conviction?
No, just not period. Necessarily. Okay, okay, yeah, yeah, the statistics don't
break it down.
Don't break it down. Yeah, but when you look at like what was the original reason people were arrested, even if they end up getting kind of caught in the cycle, drug convictions are like the easiest possible way to get arrested. I have a friend who was arrested for he had an empty bag that he had bought $8 worth of heroin in. Mm-hmm. The bag was empty, and he got a felony on his record for that because it was residue. Mm-hmm. And so you even think of things like that. It's like, this is a lifelong impact for him over something really small.
Bag, really small.
He
should have called Taylor and Cox.
Right.
There you go. So he, as I started to learn, you know, learning some things like that, and you go, whoa, we're walking around in a world that people don't have any idea what is actually happening as a result of how many people are getting put in jails and prisons for drug possession. Drug possession is the top reason why people get put in prison in Mississippi. Now, there's people that get put in there for other things.
I believe it.
But drug possession, we're not talking trafficking. We're not talking sales. This is possession, the number one reason why people get incarcerated. So I'm learning about this, and I wonder, is anybody else in Mississippi interested in this? So I start hosting, I hosted a book discussion, and I used Johan Hari's book, Chasing the Scream. It was like the best thing that I had read on my own learning journey, and people came. So there was 12 people at the first discussion. Then I had one a few months later. There was 24 people there.
This would have been about 5 or 6 years ago?
This was in 2017.
Uh-huh. Okay. So maybe put it out through social media or just your small
group. Yeah, it was really like invite my family and invite like anybody that had ever commented on a Facebook post I made about this issue, which wasn't that many people.
Right, right. Got to start somewhere.
You got to start somewhere. Yes, you got to start somewhere. So did that, and they just kept growing. And then I had a dad who had lost his son to a heroin and fentanyl overdose. He invited me to come and do one in Hattiesburg. So he invited his community, went there and hosted one of those discussions. It was a packed house in one of the restaurants there. And it just kept growing, became a 501c3 as we, and I say we because there was always other advocates that were part of this, whether or not they eventually became part of End It For Good's team or just people that wanted to see this conversation happen. And it was happening in Mississippi. We're the most conservative religious state. You know, year after year, we're like right up there with Alabama.
That's right.
And people were seeing this isn't an issue of like progressive. This is like, how do we help people? And I would say, I'm still conservative and still a Christian. I would say, I think this is actually, when we look at outcomes, it's a more conservative approach than what we have been doing because it is helping more people stay alive. It's helping families stay together and be healthier. It's helping communities have less crime. We haven't gotten into how that would happen yet,
but
there are so many angles of this that improve not just the life of the person who's struggling with an addiction, but the rest of the community who's not using at all. All of our lives are impacted.
And resources.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I just... what keeps me going still today is this deep belief that when we look at the world, we all want to find big levers of how to make it better. Like, it's awesome to change one life, but if you can change a million, that's even better. Let's pull the big switch.
Yeah.
And so the more I've learned, I have become convinced that this is one of the biggest switches that we could pull. It impacts not just our country. It impacts countries all over the world. It impacts immigration. It impacts why people want to leave countries where cartels have taken over.
Right.
And so there's so much impact. It tends to be that the most vulnerable people experience the worst of the impact. So for me, as somebody who is thinking about not just how does the world work for people with resources, but how does it work best no matter what family you're born into, no matter what opportunities you have, how can we make the best chance for you to live an amazing life and contribute to society? I think this is one of those issues.
I don't disagree.
I mean, like it too. Yeah.
It impacts, like you said, a lot of people, not just in Mississippi, but.
Yeah. And it's through the whole gamut. I mean, you could be really, really poor and come from a really poor household, or you could be really, really rich and fall into the same boat. Or
make it probably even easier if you're super rich. Because then
you got it right in front of you.
Yeah. So you started to host the discussions, you'd say.
Yeah.
Started the nonprofit. And then what? Like, you're still learning, right? Mm-hmm. You're still trying to figure out what developing, like, would you say, like, your own thesis of how things should be, or your own plan, where change should start and how?
Yeah. So it was kind of started with those book discussions. And then at the end of 2018, I got a invitation to go speak to a group of community leaders in Jackson. They had heard about these discussions that I was doing, and they were like, come and tell us your spiel. And I was like, well, the spiel is you got to read this whole book, right, you know, and then I'm going to come and lead a discussion with you. And not surprisingly, they're like, we don't want to read the book.
Right.
We just want you to come.
Give me the cliff notes.
And so I thought, well, this is terrifying. I don't know. Like, I have not done that. I haven't put it into my own words. I haven't consolidated this down. I've just been like taking this other resource and,
right,
and pointing kind of people
Q&A,
to it, you
right?
know, Q&A. Yeah. So I thought, okay, but I don't want to turn down any opportunities. So I'm just going to do this. So I made my own PowerPoint. I'm not a designer. I just tried to think through how can I make what makes sense to me? How can I convey that in some way? And so I did that and went and presented there. Serendipitous events of one of the people who was there that day was friends with somebody that was on the TEDx committee. Mm-hmm. And there was a TEDx conference in Jackson and 6 weeks later. And he went to her and he said, I just saw this presentation. You really need to invite her to present this as a TEDx talk. And so they reached out to me. I sent in a proposal for it. They
so you must have
accepted
it. You must have had a really good PowerPoint.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very up to date.
Here's the thing, Joey. I don't think it was a PowerPoint. I think it's the idea.
Yeah, right.
People
absolutely.
Hear this and they're like, this is powerful.
Right.
This really, if you stay with it long enough to understand what we're doing, and you catch that vision, it really is inspiring.
Right.
It's not that it's me. That's not me. I'm just saying these are things I learned, and I think most people are like me and don't know.
Right.
We've just taken what we've been told. We've never thought about underground markets and crime before. Right. We've never thought about why are people dying from fentanyl, on the street, but they're not dying in clinics where they're being given fentanyl every day. My
Correct.
Own son, I tell the story in Curious of my own 4-year-old son being given fentanyl in a medical setting, mm-hmm. and it causes no problems at all. It's a helpful, it's
I
helpful
tool. I could have been the one that gave it to him.
Well, I think it's a buzzword that's on the news
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
Fentanyl.
And you mentioned we have her book here, Curious. And we'll get into that more throughout the discussion. But so yeah, that's, I'm glad to hear you mention that part of it as well with the fentanyl, because we briefly discussed that before we went live as well. But so the TEDx, I watched that 2 years ago whenever mm-hmm. we had Brett
yep.
on. So, and that was a great, TED Talk. It was awesome.
I was going to say, is that TED Talks?
TEDx is a version
Someone,
of it.
Yep.
And it was awesome. And it is eye-opening and hopefully does cause a lot of people to rethink, you know, what they think about drug policy. So if we were to get into the weeds a bit or to the nuts and bolts of it, you mentioned 1 in 10 people in Mississippi have a felony,
mm-hmm.
right? 1 in 4 is a drug-related
crime.
It's
just some criminal conviction.
Criminal conviction. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yep.
I said that wrong. Criminal conviction. We know that it sticks with people. Probably people are familiar with or know someone that's been affected by it, family, friend, yeah. coworker, something. Where would you say, how do we frame this? Where do we start to talk about reform?
Yeah.
So I think a big part of it is just, so when I gave that TEDx talk, I boiled down to 20 minutes. What is this, like we've said, the super complicated mm-hmm. issue. But you can understand the nuts and bolts of that in the 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about it in, we often talk at End It For Good about the 3 harms. There's a lot more harms to the way that we approach drugs, but you can kind of boil them down to 3, where you think about what happens to markets when you criminalize them, what happens to substances when you take them outside of regulation
right.
and you put them in that free-for-all of an underground market, and what happens to consumers when you criminalize them. So it's kind of like, what happens when you use a criminal justice approach to consumers, to markets, and to substances?
There was a real life experiment that went down called Prohibition that
right.
we kind of
yeah.
know a lot about.
Yeah.
Al Capone, might have people have heard about
mm-hmm.
him. You know,
yeah.
created a lot of crime
right.
for
yep.
something. Socially, you know, alcohol is a lot more accepted in the United States,
mm-hmm.
I know for sure, and probably most countries around the world. It is a very social drug, but
yeah.
it has a ton of problems that it causes.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
but
most people, as much as anything else.
Most people, I don't think, view alcohol as a drug, right?
Mm-hmm.
But going back
yeah.
to Prohibition, I mean, we saw how that worked.
Right.
Or didn't work.
Yeah. And in my own mind, I had never put that connection together before about what happened when we prohibited alcohol. We kind of have this cultural knowledge, like it didn't work, so we stopped doing it.
Yeah.
But we haven't, for people like me that, you know, economics wasn't the thing I studied in school. I have a degree in Bible. You know, it just wasn't my like area.
Jesus turned water into wine.
Right. You're right. Come on. Yeah. Yeah. So I hadn't thought about the fact that, oh, during alcohol prohibition, alcohol didn't go away. Of course,
not
we know that.
At all.
It just but got nastier.
It got, right. There's no quality control. You have no idea what you're drinking. And yeah, the only people making money during that time are people who are breaking
the
law.
Right? Yeah.
Well, and your average person who, I forget how long prohibition was, how many years, but the person who was drinking the day before that started and the day after it ended, in between there, now he's a criminal, right?
Yep.
And he's like, well, I was doing this before.
The same thing I was doing before.
And could have been an alcoholic who ruined his whole life and beat up his wife and ruined his family, or it could have been the guy who got up and went to work every day and had a couple on the weekends, or you know the whole gamut, the whole spectrum of alcohol use.
Right. So there's, when you think about prohibition, you think about what didn't work about that. It's the exact same things that aren't working about the prohibition of other drugs today. So when we have, let's think about something like kratom. So kratom comes into the U.S. market a couple of years ago. Nobody's there ever heard of kratom before that.
Right.
It's made from the leaves of a tree.
Yeah.
So it comes, and you can develop a problem with kratom, especially if it's unregulated and you don't know what's in it. It can be laced with different things. That can be a problem also. And so our gut response when we have something new that comes in and can potentially be problematic is we just say, let's ban it. Mm-hmm. Then all the problems will be gone. Let's think about what happens when you ban something. You push it out of a legal market, out of a legal market. It goes into an underground market.
Yep.
There are no quality controls.
Right. No,
you don't know who's buying it. You don't know who's selling it. You don't
what's
know
going
what,
in it.
What's going in it. You lose all control. So we have kind of been taught the ultimate form of regulation is to prohibit something.
Right.
That is the absence of any kind of regulation.
And that's pendulum swinging from one end to the other.
Yes. And so we still believe this untruth that criminalizing something, that banning something is like the best way you can control it.
Right.
That's why you keep it from getting in people's hands.
Well, I guess from the government or whoever's point of view, it's the easiest knee-jerk reaction to get rid of
it. It's a knee-jerk reaction. So we've got to make a distinction between reactions and solutions.
Right.
Because we've had 100 years of drug policy that has been reactions. Something's potentially problematic, let's just ban it, then we don't have to deal with it.
Right.
You do still have to deal with it. All that means is now the people
There's
selling
no
kratom
yeah.
are going to mm-hmm. be people breaking the law. They're going to be selling whatever the heck they want. They can sell it to a 10-year-old if they want to. There's no age restrictions. There's nothing. So we have the same problems that we had during alcohol prohibition. It incentivizes crime. It financially rewards you if you engage in crime. And yet we continue to push things into that underground market. So the underground drug market is the primary funding stream of gangs, cartels, mm-hmm. terrorist organizations. They get the majority of their money from drug prohibition.
And the CIA. Because they've been caught selling drugs as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of problems with prohibition. And here's the thing. I think we also have this idea that people who commit crime, it's like a certain kind of person. Like you're kind of born that way or you're not. You're either going to be a criminal or you're not. Mm-hmm. In this issue, if you think about you're growing up and you look around and you say, you know, I could go get a job working minimum wage. That's going to be tough and I'm going to make minimum wage.
Yeah.
Or right over here is this massive economy that is the underground drug market and I could make 3 times as much and all I have to do is like go sell some drugs.
Right.
We know human nature. Human nature likes money.
Absolutely.
We are drawing people. We're giving incentives to people to go commit crime so that they can make more money.
That's on so many rap albums that I can think of right now.
Every
that whole story,
yeah.
right? Like go
stand in a corner,
do this,
yeah.
or
slanging
go,
dope. Yeah,
yeah. Biggie Smalls. Rap. I mean, that's all their story. It was like you can't make any money any other way in this environment. So why would I not do that?
Yeah. So we can say, well, they shouldn't.
Right.
And you're right. They shouldn't.
Right.
But we know human nature. People like to make money. And you've got this massive pile of cash from the underground drug market. it's just, we know people are going to go sell those drugs. They're going to make that money. They're going to break the law doing it. You can't settle disputes. If you're breaking the law, you can't go to the police to help you settle your
disputes.
Somebody
stole my drugs.
You can't do that. You got to go do that yourself. So we get all of this crime within the market as people are fighting each other over trade routes, over, you know, whatever corner
territory,
it is that they're
going
to be on, their territory.
My turf.
Yeah. And all of that money is going into the pockets of people who are breaking the law, who are then using it to do more criminal endeavors. So it is not, drug prohibition does not make us safer. It is not fighting crime at all. Mm-hmm. It is providing a financial incentive. It's a funding crime. And that's why people continue to engage in it. Consumers still want to buy drugs. If they can't buy them legally, they will buy them illegally. Mm-hmm. And that has increased. So if what we've been doing for 50 or 100 years is working, we should see drug use decreasing. And what we see instead is that illegal drug use has doubled in the last 20 years across the country and here in Mississippi.
I believe
we're trending in the wrong direction. We need a different approach.
Yeah. I agree with that.
But it goes back to the pendulum as well. You had to, let's cut it all off. But then on the other side, when it swings back in, what do we do on this side? Do we just open everything up? You know what I'm saying? So where's the happy medium in the middle of it?
Yeah, I hope not. I hope we don't just.
right.
Yeah, just open everything up.
Yes. So what we have with alcohol is not a perfect system, but it is a system where we have a potentially harmful substance. We have people who are wanting to use it.
Right.
We have ways that we protect the community, laws against, you know, drunk driving and things like that. But we also have social norms around alcohol. Like, if you're drinking at 8 in the morning, it's not that you're not allowed to do that. It's not socially okay to do that in most places.
Right.
You might.
Unless you're in Florida on vacation.
Crawfish.
Right.
So we have all of these social norms that we've developed around alcohol. The same is true of cigarette smoking. When you look at what has happened with cigarette smoking in the U.S., it has massively decreased. Not because we arrested anyone. We used an approach that combined education, so people know what it's going to do to you or what it can do to you over time, and social norms. So it became where you couldn't smoke on an air, you know, in the airplane
most
anymore.
Of the casinos,
you couldn't go
indoor restaurants.
Yes, it was workplaces. You think about insurance rates that are cut if you aren't smoking. So there's all these incentives and consequences that are not criminal justice involved at all. And yet we've seen rates of smoking dramatically decrease all across the country for the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
So we know that there are ways that you can approach a potentially harmful substance. You know, alcohol and tobacco kill more people in this country than any other drug 100%. Does, including fentanyl. Mm-hmm. So that the issue isn't, can we handle it some other way? We already have. We always separate them. We always talk about, you know, alcohol and drugs.
That's the phrase.
Alcohol is a drug. So we've done it before. And I think that's the kind of route we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about how can we create social norms around other types of substance use as we bring these substances back slowly into legal, regulated markets where we're not funding crime anymore. But we're also not just sort of opening the door and saying, hey, you know,
have
no big
it.
Deal.
Yeah,
just go have at it. We don't want that either. I'm sure there's some people that want that. Certainly not what End It For Good wants.
Right.
We want to say, how can we reduce harm? How can we not have contaminated substances where people are dying from fentanyl overdose because they can't dose it appropriately? When you think about why we have a fentanyl crisis, we have a fentanyl crisis because of prohibition. That's why cartels began figuring out how can we produce more potent drugs in a smaller package. Because if you got to smuggle something, you need it to be in
small
as possible.
Now, I think with the fentanyl crisis, we have a fentanyl crisis because we had a prescription drug problem where we were writing OxyContin. I mean, there's whole
thousands of them,
tons of stuff coming out now. Netflix has a special on it where Big Pharma went around and lied about the addictiveness of these opioids. And then wrote them like candy to everyone that wanted them. And then all of a sudden got caught and was like, all right, we're not going to write them anymore. Now you're going to have to jump through 1,000 hoops to get your medicine that you've been getting. So the market's there, the demand is there, and what did it get filled with? Heroin at first, and then fentanyl.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Black market.
So it's got this like this horrendous combination of things that all happen at the same time.
Right, right. Like a perfect storm.
Yes, it's a perfect storm of fentanyl is now able to be synthesized on the underground market, not just in legal pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
And you have this decrease in prescriptions that happens where a lot of people end up saying, okay, I can't get whatever my opioid of choice was from a doctor anymore. They're migrating to the underground market. At the same time, the underground market has just become incredibly potent with fentanyl in it. And so if we think about how are we going to address this, you can't do it through supply controls. You cannot seize enough drugs. Yeah. I mean, you think about
they make them every day.
Yeah, these are sophisticated business operations. The underground drug market industry is $500 billion a year globally. This is not people who are like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Yeah. I just make, you know, billions of dollars a month kind of thing. Yeah. These are smart minds that have chosen an unhealthy path to use their intellect in. And so you can seize drugs, but they're operating just like Walmart would. They know how much of whatever their product is going to get seized along the way, and they ship that much more.
Right.
You don't go to Walmart and see like, oh, half their shelves are empty because of shoplifting. No, they have figured in how much is going to get taken. We're going to ship that much more so that our shelves are always full. Mm-hmm. And so we continue to try to take drugs off the street. And actually, a study was done recently where they actually looked into the overdose rate after a big drug seizure. And more people die from an overdose after a seizure in that area. So it destabilizes the market where people might have been getting from the same dealer, from the same batch. And if those drugs are seized, which on the one hand you go, well, yeah, we don't want people using this random drugs they got on the street. But it destabilizes that area. Mm-hmm. And suddenly people now are buying from new people. Yeah. Who else has something that can be brought in? And when you have something like fentanyl on the market where the margin between getting high and dying is so thin, you end up having more people die, which is the opposite of what we want. We're trying to take those drugs off the street so they don't kill people.
Right.
And I think that's, if I think about this kind of whole big issue, the difference between intent and outcome. Mm-hmm. We intend to help. We want to help people. That's been true. I mean, we hear that over and over again from law enforcement that come to our events. We've done 35 events now in Mississippi. Lots of law enforcement coming. Everybody from narcotics officers to sheriffs to everybody in between. And they say, we want to help people. We are very frustrated that we continue to arrest the same people over and over again. Mm-hmm. It doesn't stop. Yeah. We seize drugs. It doesn't stop. They're frustrated too.
But that's their job.
That's their job. So we keep putting them out there to continue to go use this approach to drugs and addiction. And I think it's doing a disservice to law enforcement because people get into that career path by and large because they want to help their community,
right?
And they want to help keep people safe and all of the things why people would want to do that. And yet we're giving them a job that is never ending. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can arrest people over and over again. Even if you arrest dealers, there's going to be somebody else there in like 10 minutes,
right?
Because
there's money
to be made. And I think for the rest of the community, our dollars would be better spent saying, law enforcement, we want you to go hit violent crime. I mean, if you look nationwide, about half of all violent crimes are never solved. So we end up spending a lot of time arresting, you know, people who are using drugs for possession. And we have people who have experienced rape, who have had a loved one who's been murdered, who have been assaulted, for whom those crimes have not been solved. So I think no matter what part of the community you're from, whether you are in law enforcement or a first responder, or you are somebody who's just living in the community, I think we could come to a place where all of us are safer and able to do the things that really make it a positive difference in the community as far as reducing the violent crime that all of us are afraid of. We don't want to experience that ourselves or the people that we love. So when we did, one of the first events we did was down here on the coast. And there was a guy that came in, and this was back like before End It For Good even started as an organization. And he walks in the door and he's like 20 minutes early, an older gentleman. So we were like still getting set up, and he walks in the door. I walked over to just introduce myself to him. And he goes, "I've been waiting 50 years for this." I said, "What do you mean?"
I've only been doing this about 18 months,
you know? And he goes, "You know, when we criminalized marijuana in the 70s, I knew that was not going to work. And I am so glad somebody is talking about this out loud. Like, it's just time." And it wasn't that he was super like pro marijuana. Like, I've never used marijuana. I don't have an interest in marijuana. But understanding what was going to happen when we criminalized it. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to arrest a bunch of people for using it. And we're going to push that market underground. And it's not going to be good. And so that's the opportunity that we have, is to begin to rethink what we're doing and make some slow changes. I'm not somebody that wants to just change everything overnight. But how can we make those slow changes where, hey, could we at least start with drug possession is not a felony? Like, loading people with felonies for the rest of their life over a drug possession charge, it doesn't help them. It doesn't help the rest of the state. It doesn't help our economy. We got employers that have loads of unfilled jobs and because they can't find enough people.
Millions of tax dollars going to them.
Yes, yes. Can we just start somewhere like that? Let's find the things that we can agree on and work on those things. It's okay if we don't agree on everything.
Right.
I might be working on this in 40 years, and I'm going to come back, and you guys are going to be on episode, 3010.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking about some of these, the more tip of the spear things that we hope to see happen.
Yeah, this goes back to the 70s with Nixon and the war on drugs. I was reading here, I pulled this article up because it was a quote that I remembered and I didn't want to get it wrong. But 71 is when he declared the war on drugs. And that's where a lot of this stuff starts from, Schedule One, making things, Schedule One illegal drug. But it came out in an interview. This was the quote that I remember hearing in 94 from his domestic policy chief, John. I'm gonna mess his last name up, but it's Ehrlichman, John Ehrlichman, mm-hmm. Nixon's domestic policy chief. That at least how did he phrase it? I want to get this right. They had at the time the White House had two enemies: the anti-war left and black people. So it was racially motivated to begin with in the Nixon administration. So you talk about criminalization and you think of like they're doing it to protect the population and the society. And it comes out in this 94 interview that that wasn't even necessarily the beginning of all this, to make society better. And we can definitely see that it hadn't worked, right? Just straight making everything illegal. So I bring that up to say, like, with In It For Good, are y'all... Because I kind of know the answer to this, but for the people watching, there's two types of philosophies, and they probably have blending of both, but like completely decriminalizing everything or legalization, right? Two separate things, if you could speak mm-hmm. to that.
Yeah. So this is terms I had never heard before I started doing this work. So I'm going to assume other people hadn't heard of me either.
Correct.
So the term decriminalization means not arresting consumers for drug possession. So that's like decriminalizing the act of possessing a drug. Then you have legalization, which is a market question. Are you going to allow whatever drug it is to be legally produced, legally sold?
What we're going through with the marijuana.
Yeah. Right. Yep. Yeah, yeah. Yep. And so when you think about that, I think people, we go to our worst fear, which is like, wait a second, heroin in the candy aisle? Nobody wants heroin in the candy aisle.
Right.
This is not a good plan. When you think about the types of legal drugs that we have lots of different regulatory options. I mean, you can go drink beer at a bar. Mm-hmm. You can go buy it from the store. You can go get a prescription from a pharmacy. You can go buy something from a pharmacy without a prescription, but you still need to show an ID because they want to be sure that you're not, going to go make meth or whatever you buy. And so we have these different regulatory structures. We don't even think about them because they've just been with us. Mm-hmm. So we would say we should look at each drug individually and figure out the best regulatory structure for its potential risks. Mm-hmm. That sounds scary, but we have got to keep in front of us that if you want to make a drug incredibly dangerous, criminalize it.
Yeah.
You're going to send it in a complete free-for-all, and kids can order it on Snapchat, and they can be 12
years old.
Already
happening.
And they will get whatever off of the dark web, whatever shows off the, yes, on the doorstep. Now, we as parents don't want to think about that. Mm-hmm. We do not want to believe that that is really the world that we live in. It is really the world that we live in. And 100%. So we would say legally regulating some of these markets again, allowing some of these drugs to be sold legally, still makes me uncomfortable. I think the risk versus reward of having some regulatory control over those drugs, over age restrictions, over quality control, mm-hmm. potency and purity, how do we get fentanyl out of the drugs that people are using? That's only possible if we get some regulatory control. That's only possible if we're going to allow some of these drugs to come back into legal markets again. So we would say that even though it makes us uncomfortable, even though it's hard to do, even though there's going to be some pain involved in that, it's the path out of the majority of the harm that we associate with these drugs. Yeah. So on the market side, that's a harder thing for people to consider, but it is the best way to reduce
probably save some lives too. When you're talking about dirty, like fentanyl and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
On the decriminalization side, I think that's probably a lot easier for people to wrap their head around and or get on board with. Yep. And I think a lot of those steps have been made in some ways, varying from state to state for sure. But you mentioned the event that you had and having had law enforcement there. I was at one of those events. You also had drug court, which is something that I'm not sure how old drug court is, like when it first was introduced, but a way to siphon nonviolent drug-only offenders off in court, siphon them off to a specialty court that can then give them a path to not having that misdemeanor or felony on their record, which I think is a great thing because then that has accountability and redemption, I guess, maybe, without going to jail and having this, you know, stigma or mark on your permanent record. So that is happening now. And then, like you mentioned, decriminalization to simple possession charges, not necessarily picking those people up and bringing them down to jail for ridiculous amounts of time.
For a bag.
Yeah, for not the guy who had, you know, 10 pounds or whatever kilos of something in the back of his trunk that he was trying to take from Texas to another state. That's a different thing.
Yep.
So the decriminalization part seems to me to be easy to understand. The legalization part, as you said, is a little bit different or harder to wrap your head around. And I think, you know, not all drugs are created equal. Right now we have, I mentioned earlier, like the schedule process that I think the Nixon administration started from one all the way down to 3, 4, 5, wherever it ends. But like having marijuana in the same schedule still at the federal level, regardless of what the states have done, in the same box as methamphetamine and heroin. Seems a little bit antiquated and ridiculous at this point, right?
Yeah, if you see, there's a chart out there that shows like the scheduled drugs on one side, and then it shows their risk potential on the other side.
Right.
And the lines are like all over the place.
Right.
Like it should be that they go straight across. You know, the most potential for harm drugs are in the highest categories of restriction, and then it kind of goes down from there. It's not at all. It has so much more to do with whatever was demonized in the public consciousness at some point.
As I mentioned earlier, not pure intentions to begin with. Right?
So you look at some of the messaging around marijuana, you know, 50 years ago around the time this was happening. And we would look at that today and say, that's nuts. Like, surely people didn't believe that. But we're all susceptible to what, I mean, we're not pharmacology, you know.
Well, we don't know.
So we kind of take what we're told oftentimes.
Well, and the media was a lot different back then, right?
Yeah,
it was way more control with a lot less options. And
so you
internet.
Just, you watch the news and whatever the
Nancy
news
Reagan
gave you.
Said and Walter Cronkite.
That's also when the cigarettes were going crazy
Yes. And so, that's a great point. It used to be like, your doctor recommends, you know, this brand of cigarette, you know, and we're like, what on earth?
The commercials, the NASA, Marlboro Red guy.
Yes. And we recognize now, wait a second, that was not healthy.
Yeah. And they lied about it and they knew it? No way. I don't believe it.
So now we know better, and now our behavior has changed accordingly, as we have decided that smoking cigarettes for most people is not worth what they get from it. And so we have this, I see it as this kind of like window of opportunity where we can begin to make this change. here's the thing. If we don't make this change, we're losing about 100,000 people a year to overdose right now. It's record highs almost every year. Fentanyl's not going anywhere.
Right.
And fentanyl is just the latest of the highly potent
it's
drugs.
It's a buzzword, yeah.
It is. It's just, hey, they figured out how to add fentanyl to drugs on the street. Now it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Now we have nitazenes. Most people haven't heard of nitazenes, but they've heard of fentanyl. Even though 10 years ago they hadn't heard of fentanyl, but they'd heard of, you know, heroin. Now we have nitazenes. Nitazenes are far more potent than fentanyl is. Mm-hmm. And now they're showing up all over the country. They're showing up here in Mississippi. I was just hearing about it this morning. So in 10 years, we're not going to be talking about fentanyl anymore. We're going to just be talking about nitazenes. And then after nitazenes, what's going to come next? Well, you got carfentanil. It's like way more potent than fentanyl. It's a large animal tranquilizer. Is that going to be the thing? It was in some big cities a couple of years ago. So it's important to understand that the potency issues that we're dealing with are a function of an underground market that's trying to figure out how to get the biggest punch in the smallest package.
Yeah.
And they're going to keep doing that because they make more money the more drugs they're able to smuggle that don't get caught, and tiny packages
are really
helpful. And the
cheaper they can do
it,
whatever they can
throw
in it.
Very cheap, very cheap. I was reading this report on fentanyl a couple of days ago, and it was talking about how the price has dropped so dramatically from like what it used to cost someone to buy like some sort of heroin concoction. Mm-hmm. You know, once you add fentanyl in there, I mean, the price is just cut into almost nothing because you can produce so much of it. With fentanyl, it's synthetic, so you don't even need to grow a plant. Mm-mm. You can just produce it anywhere.
Yeah.
And so that's what we have. We have the reality of the underground drug market, and we have an opportunity. Are we going to continue down that same path? We know where it's going to take us. We've been walking the path for 50 years. It's going to give us more and more high potent drugs with no quality control, no age restrictions. And that's where it's going to keep going. Mm-hmm. It does not matter how much we try to get those drugs off the street. As long as there's money to be made, there's going
to
be people who are selling it. And the more we take off the street, the higher the incentive is to figure out how to make that package even smaller.
Yeah.
And that's going to mean more potency, more risk factor for people who are using. So I see it as an opportunity to say, let's learn from where we're at. Let's try to get above those trees. And let's try to look at this whole forest of why so many people are dying,
right,
of why there's so much crime, of why so many people are fleeing Central and South American countries. Those are complex reasons. But when you have cartels that have basically bought the whole government of mm-hmm. some country, and when you have violence where people can't even live in peace in their own home because they're seeing dead bodies hung off of, you know, bridges. I mean, just crazy stuff that we can't imagine here. But that's coming from this underground drug market. So I think we have an opportunity to say we don't want to keep going down that path. This other path feels a little scary. Mm-hmm. It's definitely going to have some pain along the way. But it's going to be pain leading us to a better place instead of pain that is leading us nowhere but more pain. I mean, I think that this term of drug war is really a disservice because wars can be won if you have enough firepower. Like if you just put enough in it, if you get enough planes and tanks and guns and bullets, you can subdue the enemy. It's just not how this works.
Yeah.
This is an economic question of supply and demand. As long as people want drugs, somebody's going to produce them, and people are going to get whatever the heck they produce in whatever little baggy mishmash of something that they get. And they're going to get things like fentanyl, and we're going to continue losing lots and lots of people.
I don't know if I said it earlier, but I think I did before we went live. You mentioned your daughter had fentanyl. Was it your daughter?
Yeah, my son.
Your son. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Your son. And I mentioned this at your event 2 years ago. But like, fentanyl is a wonderful drug when it's used in the appropriate setting in an operating room where it's designed to do what it's supposed to do. So I want people to understand that. It's like, well, why would anybody even create this drug? Well, it has a place, it has a purpose, you know. And when it's used out of that context, and it does have a high probability of of abuse for someone, not everybody.
Yep.
And using it in an OR or during a surgery and then stopping it is a lot different than taking a pill form for months and months and months and months for a chronic injury or cancer. Maybe you really should have been taking it that long, or missed people that are writing prescriptions that shouldn't be to patients that don't need it, who then mm-hmm. get hooked. It's a different ball game as to why certain people get addicted to certain things, you know. And then, like you say, you have people who get addicted to alcohol, and that's so many people drink that don't get addicted to it. So it's there's a lot of factors involved in that type of stuff. So another point you brought up about the legalization, not necessarily devil's advocate, but to kind of push back on, legalization doesn't always remove the black market effect, because I think we can see in states where the legalization of marijuana has passed, even on the recreational level, that there still has been a black market for marijuana, a lot of times having to do with price, because maybe the black market can provide it cheaper because it's not being taxed. Can you speak to that? Is that something that you're aware of?
Yeah. That's a great point, because that is what happens. So think about the difference between whether or not there's a thriving alcohol underground market and whether there is still a thriving, you know, marijuana underground market. And what you see is that in states that have really high taxes on marijuana or really tight regulations, their underground market continues to thrive because it's still an economic question. So you have consumers. Let's say I've got $10 that I want to spend on marijuana, and I'm choosing, am I going to spend it at the far more expensive dispensary? Now, it is a known quantity, like it's going to have regulation around it and all of that, but it's going to be a whole lot more expensive. I'm going to get way less marijuana for my $10 than I am.
A whole lot more hoops to jump through because I got to get a car.
Yes. Or I can just go to the guy down the street and buy from him, and it's going to be cheaper. And I think he's, you know, got a pretty good supply.
Right.
As we allow the market to operate, now I'm more of a small government person myself, more pro market friendly. Although I think it's good to still have some regulations on markets. Don't just let them run wild. Particularly in the drug space, I think there's some good mediums where we've got some good regulations. But you know, you can't force people to buy from a legal business. Like, consumers are still going to make a choice. Right. You can incentivize them to by making it competitive, where they would say, I can get the same thing from the dispensary for my $10, or I can go to the guy on the street for $10. I'm just going to go to the dispensary because I would much rather be able to look at, like, the content and, you know, ingredients, know what's in it, know it's been, quality tested and all of that.
It's pure.
Yes. And so you still have, in states where there's really high taxation or really high regulations, the legal market cannot compete with the underground market, which is not a failure of legalization. Mm-hmm. It's a failure of overtaxation and overregulation that businesses can't. I mean, that's true of any industry. If you overtax and overregulate something, businesses can't survive. Right. I mean, you have to let them be able to compete in the marketplace. And so there's lessons to be learned. I think certainly even now, part of what I think has been good about marijuana legalization is that because it's happened state by state, each state can learn from the other states on what has worked, what hasn't worked. Even the cultures of different states, I think, can impact what works best in that place, where it's not just sort of this blanket policy for everybody, but we say, okay, how is it potentially going to work best here? And then the legislature makes changes every year and say, well, we're going to do this with hemp, or we're going to do this with CBD, or we're going to do this with THC content level, or whatever it is. And I think that's a good way for local governments to be able to say what's going to work best here. And there's no perfect solution. I think that's the dream we have got to kill. We all want a perfect solution, and that's what we've been chasing for 100 years, is this idea that if we just crack down hard enough on supply and on demand, nobody's going to want drugs, nobody's going to produce drugs. And we have thousands of years of human history that show us people want to change the way they feel through using substances. And as long as there's people who want to do that, there's people who are going to produce those substances. We can influence those things through social norms, through lots of different ways. We can incentivize people to make healthy choices, but trying to just force them to, it hasn't worked. It can't work. It won't work. We are much better served by educating people on the risks the real risks, not the like, if you smoke weed one time, right. it's going to destroy your life. Right. Like we've right. gotten a whole lot of people who've smoked weed one time and said, well, it didn't destroy my life. Yeah. So I think the whole rest of this is probably, you know, not right. going to apply to me. So, yeah. I think that's, those are some of the things I think that are helpful is that even in the places where we come up against something hard, we go that the legal marijuana industry is not perfect either. Nope, it's not. But at least there's some regulations. There's more people buying legally than all buying illegally. So for everything that I came up against, this is true, you know, 7 years in or whatever it is, every time there's something I go, what about this? And what about that? Approaching it through a legal regulated way or shifting away from the criminal justice approach doesn't solve all the problems, but there's no problem that prohibition solves better.
Right.
It's correct. So there's no, it's like there's no perfect solution and we keep going, we'll see what's wrong with this. Well, it's also wrong with prohibition. You go, well, you know, some of those marijuana dispensaries sell to underage kids.
Right.
Everybody on the underground market sells to underage kids. Right, like right. there's, you know, so we think about, well, what about, you know, the regulators? Some of them are corrupt in the marijuana industry. Okay, there's no regulators on the underground market.
All of them
like,
are corrupt.
Yeah, so it's like everything that's bad is worse with prohibition. We got to keep looking at that and not just looking at the negative of change, but really sit with the negatives of what we have now.
It makes me think of like when people have the discussions about capitalism, right? Like it's not perfect. Like it can be corrupt. It can, you know, we have to have anti-monopoly laws to keep people from doing too well at capitalism, but it's the best system that, in my opinion, that we have, right? That does the best for the most people and allows for the most opportunity to go from nothing yeah. to something mm-hmm. economically. So yeah. kind of the same thing you're talking about.
Yeah. Where do you think that education needs to start?
In the home. I'd say definitely in the home. But here's the thing. So I've got, my oldest is 15. I have a 15, 13, and 9-year-old boys. So even for me, I'm right in the thick of that and trying to figure out what's a better way to talk to them about this other than just don't do this. Now, I don't want them to use drugs, but we know that when kids are told don't do this,
right.
they start to think, why? That's, yeah. that sounds like something I might want to try. So I have tried to take more of an approach than it drives my kids nuts. They're like, Mom, come on. I'm like, I want them to have an honest education about this. Mm-hmm. I want them to not just try to make them afraid, but to say, here's what can happen. This is, yeah, alcohol. I do the same thing with alcohol as with other drugs. Alcohol, a lot of people can drink and be okay. And for most people who drink, it doesn't turn into an addiction. But for about 1 in 10, it does. And for those people, it significantly harms them and their family and their body and all of these negative impacts from that. So you got to know that because you don't want to just think alcohol is no big deal because, hey, you know, I see some people drinking and it's no big deal.
Right.
With other drugs, what is it that makes those drugs so dangerous? I don't want them to think, well, it's a pill, you know, so it must be like pharmaceutical grade. Now, again, I hope they're not using any pills.
Right.
But if they are, I want them to understand, no, there's pills that look just like pharmaceutical grade that can have fentanyl in it. This is what fentanyl is. This is why it's so dangerous because it's so potent and you have no idea mm-hmm. if it's going to get you high or it's going to kill you. That's a whole lot more uncomfortable type of education than it is to just say, be afraid, it'll destroy your life, don't use it.
Right.
It's easier. And we all want, you know, we want the path of least resistance, we want what's easy, but we also want what has kind of like just a bow on top quickly. Like, let's cut and dried, mm-hmm. clean lines.
Right, right, right.
And just don't do it.
I don't want to explain it.
The
end. Right,
yes, yeah. yes. And our kids have the internet now. And if we tell them something that's not true, they will know in 3 seconds. They can Google it.
yeah.
yeah.
Well, like,
is that true?
That's scary.
No, yeah. You know?
It's like, just say no, right? Like that leaves a lot of
yeah.
questions. Just well, say yeah. no. Yeah. I mean,
this is your brain.
This is your brain,
on drugs.
Right.
drugs.
It's like, yeah. it's a great, I mean, we still remember the slogan.
My brain's going to fry. Right. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. I was doing a presentation at a college class a couple of years ago. And so the way I like to do them is I do a presentation, then we go around the room. Everybody gives their feedback on that. That's how we do events of
yeah,
ours,
yeah.
you know, also. So And one of the guys, you know, it's, everybody's been talking and sharing, and one of the guys was like, so here's the thing. When I was in like middle school, we had, you know, police officer that comes and does this whole, the whole DARE program. Right. And like, you know, it, which the DARE program was a lot of fear. Like, yes. You know,
I had it at my school. I remember.
Yeah. So he goes, we hear the DARE program. Me and my friends all meet up at the vending machine like we do after every class. And immediately everyone goes, we have got to get our hands on some of that.
Wow. The
this sounds like, wait, it's going to, you know, that's just, it's not how we
want kids
to think,
yeah.
But like that, it just, ooh, this is, wow, this sounds like dangerous.
Yeah.
And like, you know, 13-year-olds are, their brains aren't fully formed. Yeah. They don't know that this is not a good thing to do.
And we didn't know any better back in the day because we couldn't Google anything.
Right.
Now, it's force-fed into them. Every song that they listen to, every show that they watch has something to do with it.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the Columbia professor, Carl Hart, and his stance on that? Like, it's a whole other side of the equation.
Yeah, it is. So he would be much more in favor of kind of destigmatizing recreational use for adults. That makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that he's not brilliantly smart. He is way smarter than I am. But I still, so for me, just from where I'm coming from, I think we're not all always aware of our own risk factors for addiction to start. And sometimes things happen in our lives that we might have had a non-problematic use of, you know, alcohol.
Correct.
And we go through something really traumatic and all of a sudden we're drinking all the time.
Yep.
And so for me, I just, there's still a part of me that is very much wants to be careful with the use of mind altering substances. Mm-hmm. And one of our kind of core values is we don't promote drug use. We don't celebrate it. We're never going to say it's okay. It's no big deal. Even if it's true, which it is, that most people who use drugs don't become addicted to them, there is still, the risk is still there.
You're always kind of playing with fire. And even if you don't become addicted, because that's like the big word, like the extreme, I think anybody who's ever, you know, even drank to some point has probably had one night where they acted like they, or wish they hadn't acted a certain way, or was like, I probably wouldn't have said that, or done that, or got that mad, or got that happy if it wouldn't have been, you know, for alcohol or whatever.
Yeah,
so there's a big in-between between just like using and then addiction. There's all this other stuff in the middle that can be not good. And then some things that are good, you know, a great conversation or a, what they call it, a social lubricant, you know, and at parties and stuff. So, I mean, it's a complex issue, but we got to talk about your book real quick. Tell us a little bit about it. Sitting here, Curious right here. You can see it on the camera here.
Yep. So I wrote Curious. It just came out a couple of months ago, and I wrote it because I felt like we were doing these events all over the state, and they were really successful. And people would come, they would hear kind of this short version, and they'd still have a whole bunch of questions. Like, whoa, okay. Probably the most common thing that we hear is, I've never thought about it like this before.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not rocket science, something new. It's just, this is maybe a way that you've never thought about it before.
Different point of view.
Different point of view.
Yeah.
And different way of approaching the harm and how we could potentially solve some of those harms. And so I wanted to say, okay, what's like, Is this a helpful resource to that conversation for people, to give them a way to dive a little deeper if they think there's something to this, but they're just still not quite sure about it?
Mm-hmm.
And the book Chasing the Scream, which is what we started with, and we still give copies of those out. It is incredible. It's well researched. It's story driven, but it's still a long book. And the author is not coming from a Christian worldview or anything like that. He's not conservative. And so I wanted to write something that really spoke to my community,
right?
The majority of people here in Mississippi who are coming from a point of view that is more similar to mine than to, you know, that author's. And to say, as a Christian and as somebody who's conservative, this is how I'm thinking through these issues. This is how the value system that I'm operating out of is informing the way that I approach these issues. And I would say my values have not changed through this whole experience, through this whole learning journey. I learned new things that changed the solutions that I think are best in line with my values. So it's not that I suddenly went, oh, you know, the Bible's not important anymore, whatever, right, at all. It's that I said, okay, my values as a Christian actually think lead me to a different conclusion as I begin to learn about some of these issues that I really didn't know that much about. And I wanted to do it in a way that was really short chapters, because I love to read a book with short chapters. It makes me feel very successful when I'm oh, here I am at the end of another chapter.
36. You know?
Yes. So I wanted to do that. I want it to be really story driven. So every chapter starts with a story. I wanted to write it as kind of a memoir. So it's kind of my learning journey and all the questions I ask myself on this own, you know, this journey. Like, I'm learning about this. Well, wait, how does my faith impact that? What about the concerns I have for my kids as a mother? What about the way that I think about the role of government and society and social norms and values as a conservative? All these different things. So I wanted to put it in a form where people could really see it from the whole arc, from beginning to end, but in a really simple way. This is not a policy book. Mm. This is a story of my own learning journey and the things that I learned that I think are one of these big levers that could change the world in a really positive way, and certainly here in Mississippi. And so put that together in a book. It tells the story of lots of other Mississippians who are part of that journey as well, the things I learned from them, from parents who lost children, from parents whose children are still struggling with addiction, from people who have been through addiction themselves and are in recovery. Their stories are in there too. So it's a very Mississippi book. It's a lot of Mississippi people
absolutely
in it. And really written for people that have the values a lot of us here have and want to see that better world happen, are frustrated that it's not happening mm-hmm. with the current approach, and want to know if there's something else out there. And I think there is. And I put curious out in the world to give
there
people an opportunity.
Yeah. Where can people get it if they'd like? No, you had it.
You can get it on Amazon, and we're also going to give away some free copies. So
okay,
first five people to email us at curious@enditforgood.com. Email us curious@enditforgood.com. Tell us you heard about it on Brownwater Banter. We're going to send you a free copy. But if you don't get one of those free copies, you can go on Amazon, buy a copy. It's priced very affordably. Mm-hmm. The audiobook will be out in the next month, and that will be priced affordably also. I think you can get the Kindle version for less than $5.
There you go.
This is not a money-making venture for us. This
right.
is, we want to put out content in the world that can help people see there is hope. There's a better path forward. We don't have to agree on everything. That book is not a hard sell for legalization.
Right.
This
right.
is to say there's a whole different way we could approach this. Mm-hmm. And whether you think just one of those little steps is the right thing, or whether you think they're all the right thing, let's work together on wherever we have agreement. We can save some lives and help some families.
Just getting people to think about it and maybe question their own, I don't know if beliefs or whatever is the right word, but are we going about it the right way? You mentioned that through this whole process as a Christian, you've never let go of any of your
mm-hmm.
beliefs
yep.
during this discovery. You know, sometimes they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? Like we may think that this current system is the best and we mean the best by doing it this way, but it does have effects that are negative, whether you realize it or not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. And I think, you know, we've been doing it for so long this way that we just think it's
right.
like this normal,
right.
like the world we live in feels like just sort of the status quo. Like at this, we're kind of at neutral. And then when we think about changing anything, that's when we start thinking about risk.
And,
like, oh, I don't know, something bad might happen.
And that's on anything, whether yeah. it's drugs or any kind of political issue. It's like, well, even though it's bad right now, at least it's not my fault. You know,
right.
like a politician's like, at least it's not my fault, and I didn't spearhead the change. And the
right.
new bad,
yes.
you know, even if it's not as bad as the current bad, it's still new bad, and people don't know new bad. I don't
That's
want to
right.
need to do that. Yeah.
That's right.
The
yes.
phrase we use in education is, that's the way we've always
right,
done it.
Exactly. Yeah. Right, exactly.
That's
so
the way we've always done it.
I don't know why, but that's just how we've always
that's
done.
What the guy told me, but who started before me.
That's
yeah.
right.
So
that's
we're just
right.
doing it the same way.
Yep.
Can you
yep.
say that email address one more time? I want to make sure people heard it
yep.
to, for the books.
Yep. It is curious@enditforgood.com.
All right. So if they send in an email, first five,
yep.
we'll get a copy of the book sent
yeah.
to them. If you want to buy it, go on Amazon, check it out. What is the future top few things that End It For Good is going to be doing in the next 6 months to a year? What's on the horizon?
Yeah, we got a couple of events coming up this fall. So if you sign up for our newsletter, we'll send out the information. Those will be in Mississippi. You can come to one of those. We'd love to have you there free. We'll feed you a great dinner.
You'll get to be part of it. Yes, it was open discussion.
Where you get to give your perspective. It's not just you coming and listening to me. So we'll be doing a couple of those. We actually just today released a report called Healthy and Hired. It's looking at the business impact on Mississippi's economy of approaching drug possession, particularly as a criminal justice issue, and all of the harm that comes to our workforce because of that. So people can go grab a copy of that off of the website. This is not like, you know, a 40-page white paper. This is like really simple, very clear. We pull out some of the main statistics in nice big and bold print, you know, if you just want to go skim. But even when you think about economy and business, it's being affected by how we're approaching drugs and addiction. So that's going to be part of, we'll be going all around the state doing presentations related to that report later on this year. And then we're looking at expanding. How can we bring Alabama, Louisiana, Tennessee, how can we bring in more states into this conversation so that we can make a change quicker for the better? I think we can do it here in Mississippi. We're beginning to see that. Even last year, we had fentanyl testing strips that were legal, made legal in the Mississippi legislature through a bill there. And so that's been a great shift to see happen. Instead of just fentanyl's a problem, who can we arrest and and lock up for longer? We're saying fentanyl's a problem, how can we save lives?
Right.
That's the kind of thing we need to be thinking about.
The fact that you couldn't even get Narcan, you know, which is a reversal agent for fentanyl, it was mind-blowing to me. I mean, now you can. I think you can buy it over the counter, I believe. But I'm like, why was that a thing? You know, like,
why would you testing, not want to save somebody?
Correct. Yeah. Well, yeah. Because I guess they say it promotes its use. Because if you could, I don't know.
It's like a fire extinguisher.
Exactly.
All right, go by my house.
I haven't heard that analogy. That's good. Yes. Or like seatbelts.
Right.
Well, just because we have seatbelts, are we like promoting bad driving?
Correct. Yeah.
No. We recognize there are people who are going to drive unsafe, or that driving in general is just a inherently risky activity.
Correct.
But we're not going to just say, well, then you're just going to die.
You're on your
own. That happens to you. You know, we say, okay, let's try to keep people alive.
Testing strips. Yep. I mean, like let's give the, okay. Yeah. I mean, maybe you don't want the government to pay for those strips, but like, let's sell them. Okay.
Yeah,
let's
do that. Okay, let a nonprofit do it. Let people buy them on their own. You know, it doesn't have to be that it's either, you know, prohibition or government funds everything.
Correct.
There's also a middle ground where we say, okay, we're just going to allow people to get this through one way or another, even if we're not spending tax dollars on it at all.
And just real quick, what's the response? Because your events have buy-in. And what I mean by that is law enforcement, court officials, I mean, just everybody, people, mm-hmm. family members. Yeah. What's been the response in Jackson? Because you had senators there. Bryce Wiggins was there, if I recall, whenever I was there. What has been the response in Jackson to End It For Good?
Really positive. People are, they want better solutions. And we're getting to a point where people are willing to be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And consider what could actually solve the problem rather than just what feels good or feels righteous or feels like we're holding the line. We're making sure people know that they shouldn't be using drugs.
The social norm thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of changing. Yes.
What do you think it's, and I hate to say it in this way, but the older generations that weren't informed, and that all they knew was shut the door on them, slam the door on them. And now we're getting a little bit more educated saying, hey, I can do something with this instead of locking them up for 30 years.
Well,
yeah. And we have great data now on that. I was actually I just saw a study. It was actually a meta-analysis, which means they're taking like 60 different studies and combining them all to see like what's the top line on it. And they found that this is not just true of drugs. This wasn't particular to drugs. They found that, you know, length of incarceration, like incarceration did not deter someone from committing crime again when they came out any more than just putting them on probation did. So that's not to say that some people don't need to be incarcerated to protect the community.
Right.
It's just to say if the thought is we incarcerate them, then they won't commit crime again.
You're
because
not, yeah.
it, d- it yeah. does not have that impact. Probation is just as effective as actually incarcerating somebody in terms of deterring future,
then
future
like
we, crime.
Like I said earlier, and it's not my quote, but it's like, you know, jail is like criminal university. Now you're in a
now you're there with the
area.
The professionals.
They can, they can teach you some things that you don't need to know.
And that's true of people who come out of prison who say, I learned how to be a better criminal right. in there. Or if I wasn't one when I went in, no, I came right. out, I couldn't get a job, but right. I did have some new skills.
I could right. sell some real drugs yeah. now. Yeah.
Not what we want to be doing. So it's been really positive. People are open to change. We're not going to all agree on change. And I think one of the things that's been most heartening to me about the work of End It For Good is that we partner and work with people who will tell me to my face, I do not agree with you
right.
on
yeah.
you know X, Y, or Z. I think you're wrong on legalization, mm-hmm. but I'm with you on fentanyl testing strips. Let's work on that.
There you go.
Like
common ground.
Yes, people want to find this common ground because it benefits all of us mm-hmm. if fewer people are dying and more families are intact and there's less crime in our communities.
Agreed.
Like all of us want that, no matter what our political right. persuasion is or whatever. It benefits everyone. So it continues to be exciting and challenging because, and here's why, people listening, you got to be talking to your elected officials about mm-hmm. this, because we got a text from one of them one day that just said, you guys need to keep doing what you're doing. This is a Republican. He said, you keep doing what you're doing because we can't stick our neck out there
yeah.
beyond
yes.
what the public is willing to
yes. yeah.
to receive. And so even if we know a policy would be helpful, if the public doesn't know that, then we're just going to get,
like
we're
going to lose
our
matter.
Election.
Yeah,
you know?
Matter.
So it's really important that people talk about these things out loud. If you think something needs to change, start talking about it with mm. the people who you're around. You have way more influence than you think you do. This is, I am convinced, this is one of my things. People just, they think, well, I'm nobody who, no, your family knows you, your friends know you, your employers know you, your coworkers know you. If you have built trust with people, they're going to listen to what you say mm-hmm. far more than they're going to listen to what I say.
Right.
So if you think there's some grain of truth here, and a lot of people come to our events and they say, I've actually been thinking about this. I've never told anyone. I haven't said it out loud before. Mm-hmm. But I have been thinking about how this is not working and what might could work better. And we want to take that private conversation people are having with themselves or just with one person and saying, how can we bring that out into the public so that people and our elected officials know, hey, we're mm-hmm. ready to make a change. It's not just the citizenry. We did an event in Hattiesburg and there were two different sheriffs that attended. Now this event had 120 people at it. There was mayor, university president, you know, lots of people
shebang.
That were influential people. And both of these sheriffs stood up. And the first one said, I've been in law enforcement for 40 years. And I can tell you that I've seen that the current approach does not work. Mm-hmm. We just arrest the same people over and over again. It doesn't get any better. It's very frustrating for law enforcement. He said, my department stands ready to make whatever changes the community wants us to make.
Mm-hmm.
So then the microphone keeps going around the room and it gets to the other sheriff. He's from a rural county, Mississippi, both from conservative places. And he says, you know, like my friend over here, I've seen the same thing. I've been in law enforcement for 40 years. I've seen the same problems, that we're not solving the problem, even though we are enforcing the law. And that's
right.
the challenge. It's not that they're not trying.
Yeah, they're doing their job.
Yes, but the laws are not helping.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, same thing. We're ready to make a change. And so that's our role as citizens, to go and start saying, we want this change. We want to use our tax dollars more effectively. We want to help people instead of making life harder for them, mm-hmm. which doesn't mean we don't have accountability. It's just a different kind of accountability that's more effective at helping people make a healthy change. And it doesn't make their lives even harder mm-hmm. to overcome addiction, because we know that some of the best help for people in their addictions are having supportive relationships, having a job to go to,
yep.
having a secure place to live. And when we incarcerate them, we take all of those things away. And then we're confused. Why it didn't get better?
Yeah.
Yep. We talked about it before on the show, the rat paradise, the study with the
yep.
rat drinking the cocaine or
yep.
the water fused until he dies. But then they reevaluated the study and said, well, that was a rat in a cage with no other interactions. They put him in Rat Park. I think it was Angie that we talked about this when she was on. But when he has other rats to hang out with and things to play with, he didn't kill himself on the cocaine war.
Right.
Humans are not, you know, too far different from that.
Yep. Yep.
You know,
we're
not
all
everybody's
the
same, but it sure helps if you got a job, some loved ones and a purpose to stop doing what you're doing.
Yep. So. And it doesn't, it's, again, it goes back to like, there's no guarantee.
Right.
There's no, that doesn't mean that your loved one is going to suddenly overcome their addiction.
But it ain't going to hurt. It's going to help.
Right.
That will help,
that's
I mean.
The thing that they need. So right now in Mississippi, there's actually something called CRAFT, Community Reinforcement and Family Training. It's free for all Mississippians right now. You can go to Allies in Recovery is the website and the organization that does it. It's grant funded for Mississippians. And what it is a tool for the loved ones of someone who's struggling with an addiction, who feel like they're at the end of their rope and we cannot deal with this anymore. And we're just going to have to cut off all ties with this person. We can't provide support for them, even emotional, much less, you know, monetary or anything like that. And CRAFT teaches family members how to engage with their loved one in a way that has been proven through studies to increase the family's health. And it increases the likelihood that their loved one reaches out for help for their addiction. So there is more to be done than just enabling or completely cutting off. Like, that's kind of what we've had. We've had like go all in and get sucked into the crazy or just cut people off completely. There is a third way there as well. People can learn CRAFT and you can learn it for free. It's an online platform and support groups are available. All of that's free for Mississippians right now. Allies in Recovery.
And I'm sure all that's on y'all's website too, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You can go check it out. We'll be happy to give you the information about it and hook you up with that, because it's not just about how do we help people who are struggling with an addiction. We want whole family health, whole community health. And that means also meeting the people who are trying to love someone who is addicted, which is really, really difficult.
Everybody's affected.
You know?
For sure.
Yep.
Well, I linked in the comments on Facebook and YouTube, a link below to your End It For Good Facebook page. So click on that if you're watching on the live or the replay. It'll also be linked in the audio podcast as well. Christina, we want to thank you for your time this evening, for stopping in and talk
with
us. Thank you for the book. Y'all go check it out. Curious. You can look it up on Amazon. Send in that email and be one of the first five and get you a free copy. And then join the email list. I'm sure on your website is one way to do it. And go check out one of the live events that they do, because I did. It was in Pascagoula at one of the hotels over there on Highway 90. And it really was an interesting event. And you did get a good meal. You got to eat. Mm-hmm. Sit down and just listen to everybody's different perspective on the issue. And like you said, not everyone agreed, but it was a very civil conversation and really felt like everyone in the room wanted to make that topic like move forward in a positive direction. And then ending it with everybody being able to speak and give their little 1 minute you know, spiel on themselves, whether they wanted to or not, was cool. It was really cool. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks everybody for watching on the lives and the replay. And if you keep tuning in, we'll keep doing them. See you on the next one. Thanks so much for checking out the show. We really appreciate the support. If you haven't downloaded the Brownwater Banter app yet, go do it. It's free in the App Store and on Google Play. We have everything covered for a day out on the water. We've got the tides, the radar, Tails and Scales app. We've got a radio station right inside of it, and it's all free. All of our content is in there. You can listen to the show directly inside of the app. Make sure you keep your notifications turned on so you can stay in touch with us as we go live with guests in the future and plan events. If y'all keep tuning in, we'll keep doing them. We'll see you on the next one. Groundwater Band.